Hello, everyone. This is The Takeaway. I'm Bridget Bergen, politics reporter at WNYC, in today for Melissa Harris-Perry. Thanks for joining us for our weekly politics show. We've got stories from all over the country to bring you today, and we begin in Washington, D.C.
We have a significant portion of one political party apparently telling pollsters that using violence to take power is acceptable. That's not the way our Constitution provides. So it's important that we tell the truth, but it's important that everyone who's a part of our wonderful country rededicate themselves to our Constitution and to the rule of law and to the premise that we are a constitutional republic.
That was Representative Zoe Lofgren of California speaking about the House Select Committee investigation into the January 6th insurrection with NPR's Michelle Martin on November 13th. To date, the committee has interviewed over 150 people to better understand who is responsible for the riots at the Capitol. Reporting late last month from CNN revealed that at least five former Trump administration staff members have already spoken with the committee. There are, however, a number of other notable names who have been less than willing to cooperate with the January 6th commission.
I'm telling you right now, this is going to be the misdemeanor from hell for Merrick Garland, Nancy Pelosi, and Joe Biden.
On November 12th, Congress charged Steve Bannon with criminal contempt after Bannon was a no-show for deposition. He also refused to hand over documentation for the committee.
If the administrative state wants to take me on, bring it, because we're here to fight this and we're going to go on offense.
Former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows also faces two counts of criminal contempt after failing to provide documents and appear before the House Select Committee. And of course, there's former President Donald Trump, who's attempting to assert executive privilege to justify withholding roughly 800 pages of documentation currently held in the National Archives. So let's talk with Kyle Chaney, legal affairs reporter for Politico. Thank you for joining us today, Kyle.
Good to be with you, Bridget.
So let's start with Steve Bannon. Does he have a case, even though he wasn't on staff at the time of the insurrection?
It's an extremely thin case when you're talking about matters of executive privilege or immunity from testifying. The whole concept of immunity, first of all, has never been upheld by a court, but it's one that was always meant to apply to the closest circle of a president's advisors. And again, even that has never really been supported by in a court of law. So the fact that Bannon, a non-executive branch employee who had been out of the White House for years and by all accounts didn't regularly talk to Donald Trump, would seem a real stretch to apply to him. But that's what he's leaning on to say, I didn't have to show up for that deposition. And that's why I think the Justice Department decided he was a safe case to prosecute because it was so clear cut.
His case is in front of Judge Carl Nichols, who was appointed by Trump. Does that give any indication of how he might rule?
You know, I wouldn't say so in this case. And we got our first glimpse of that this week when Bannon appeared before him for the first time. And Nichols was not really buying the Bannon team's argument to try to slow down the case. He really was saying, we want to take a really long time and go through these constitutional issues. And Nichols said, well, actually, I don't see it as that complicated. And let's maybe move a little faster than that. Nichols has not been easy to typecast here. He's been pretty tough on January 6th defendants. He's been pretty tough on Sidney Powell and people who are defending a Dominion voting system defamation mm-hmm. suit. So he's not really been in line with Trump and Trump allies, just because of who appointed him.
I think some of the question stems from his historical position on congressional subpoenas. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Now, this is a more interesting aspect of Carl Nichols' history. He was actually a Justice Department attorney in 2008 when George W. Bush tried to argue that his close aides were immune from testifying. And Nichols was the one who carried that argument in court. Now, he ultimately lost that case. But we heard at least one call for his recusal from someone who argued against him to say, look, he took the position that if you're close to the president, you can ignore a congressional subpoena. So how can he preside over this case? Now, that recusal matter didn't come up. That question didn't come up when Bannon was in court this week. But, you know, it's something that we should keep an eye out for because, he has at least argued for that position in the past.
Shifting gears, let's talk about Mark Meadows, the former White House chief of staff. He faces jail time and a fine of up to $100,000 for each count of criminal contempt. Would he also be forced to turn over documents?
So he has been subpoenaed to provide documents and testimony, and the committee hasn't decided whether to hold him in contempt. That's the biggest question facing the panel right now is how are they going to deal with someone like him who, like Bannon, did not appear, but at least has been more willing to engage with the committee and, you know, try to make some legal arguments and negotiate. The question is he negotiating to delay and to stall, which is what the committee has begun to suspect, or is he negotiating to reach a point where he can actually come in and provide testimony and documents?
In their pursuit of those documents, what do they think they might learn from Meadows' cell phone records?
So what they want to know, they want to be able to piece together the events of January 5th and 6th. Now, they want to know more broadly than that, about Trump's efforts to overturn the election for months after his defeat on November 3rd. They want to know who he was talking to, who he was pressuring, and which agencies to try to help him do that. But specifically on January 5th and 6th, leading up to the attack, they want to know who was the president on the phone with, or who was Mark Meadows on the phone with, to try to, you know, coordinate strategy for delaying the Electoral College vote. Were they aware of the violence? So I think they want to get a sense of when did Trump or Meadows in particular learn certain aspects of what was happening that day, and who was he calling as that was going on?
Why won't President Biden assert executive privilege over them?
So the thing here is, this is one of the most interesting fights here, is that you've never seen a case in history where when a former president wants to keep some of his White House records private, you've usually had the current administration agreeing, because in general, presidents stick together on these things. They protect the executive branch. But for the first time in history, we have a current president saying, no, the public interest in understanding the insurrection is too great for me to try to shield your White House records from the committee, from the investigators. And so that's where this conflict all boils down to and why we're seeing these fights play out in court, because Biden has said, no, I'm not going to do what all my predecessors have done and try to defend your right to keep your documents secret.
Representative Zoe Lofgren said that after the investigation is over, the committee may look at actions like revising the Electoral Count Act or the Insurrection Act. How would revising those acts prevent future attacks on the Capitol?
Sure. So the Insurrection Act is the one that a lot of Trump ally supporters who joined in the attack on the Capitol, they believed that Donald Trump was going to invoke the Insurrection Act and use it to seize voting equipment, use it to deputize militias to try to stop the Electoral College vote from happening. And a lot of that was rooted in fantasy, and it never did happen. But I think the fact that there was even a thought that it could happen is something that lawmakers want to look at to make sure it couldn't be used to target our own election process. And the Electoral Count Act, even more significantly, is the process that governs the way states certify their votes, the way they finalize the election, and the way Congress ultimately certifies the Electoral College vote. There have been so many loopholes in that that have never been addressed, because mostly it's been a formality. But we've seen now that because of those loopholes exist, when you have someone motivated to try to overturn an election, they can exploit those loopholes to try to, you know, have, for example, the vice president try to stop the counting of electoral votes. That's something they may want to tighten up and prevent, you know, so there's no mystery once the election day voting happens who the winner is going to be.
I'm speaking with Kyle Chaney from Politico, and we're talking about the January 6th commission. Kyle, who else do you anticipate will be subpoenaed?
So we've seen about three dozen subpoenas that we know of publicly, and a lot of senior White House officials under Donald Trump, people like Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany, Stephen Miller, a top advisor. And the real question is, so they've hit a lot of the high-level people. They've also hit some mid-level White House aides, and I think that's the most interesting place to watch, because those officials, they're hopeful, are not quite as bought into defending Donald Trump at all costs and may have been in the room for some of the key decisions. So the people like Steve Bannon, who will, you know, essentially fight to every possible battle for Trump, they're hoping these people may not be quite as committed and not willing to risk their own livelihoods to fight it and may talk to them. So it's those mid-level officials that I think may be the most interesting to watch.
Looking ahead, what can we expect during the hearings on November 30th regarding Trump's assertion of executive privilege to block the release of his files?
So I consider that hearing to be maybe the most important thing, that moment for the January 6th committee, because this is the federal appeals court deciding whether Trump's attempt to block the committee as a former president is valid. And now he lost pretty resoundingly at the district court level. The appeals court level, there's still obviously the Supreme Court that potentially he could take it to, but the appeals court level is going to be pretty decisive here, and it will set a precedent that's never been set before about can a former president try to shield his own records, if the current president says no. And so I think it'll be sort of a last stand for Trump here. Again, Supreme Court is always there and could nullify what happens here, but the appeals court is the first time a case like this has ever reached that level.
Wow. Are there other recommendations that the committee might make to prevent future incidents like what we saw on January 6th, future riots like what we saw on January 6th?
Yeah, I think they're looking at a number of different areas. And one is, sort of the way presidents interact with their own agencies to prevent them from being misused again and targeting things like the election process. So they might want to look at how presidents, especially after an election, can use the tools at their disposal to try to, do what Donald Trump did. I think they also want to look at security matters. That's a big, less discussed part of this is how the Capitol Police, how the intelligence community kind of missed the threat here. Because if they were prepared, we may not be talking about the attack in the way we're talking about it today. Because they would have been able to stop it before they breached the Capitol. So I think they want to talk about how the intelligence was processed, how social media gets monitored, and how the threats are determined to be serious or not, because they really missed the ball on this one.
Kyle, according to a whistleblower who spoke anonymously this week with your colleagues at Politico, the investigation is not looking closely enough at the role of the Capitol Police Department. Tell us more about what the whistleblower is claiming.
Sure. So we know that the whistleblower was a senior official with the Capitol Police and seems to think that the failures of the department itself, their unreadiness for what ultimately hit them on January 6th, is a bigger part of the story than the committee is appreciating right now and has been really beating the drum. This is a whistleblower who's been talking to us, for example, but others as well, trying to get people to pay attention to where things went wrong at the department. It's just been a really bad culture there, lack of preparedness, disorganization. They just were not ready for anything that came at them that day. And so this person really wants investigators like the January 6th committee to put more of their resources toward understanding why that went so wrong on that side of things.
We're going to have to leave it there. Kyle Chaney is a legal affairs reporter for Politico. Thank you for joining us today, Kyle.
Thanks for having me, Bridget.
This week, Florida's state legislature was back in session. Governor Ron DeSantis called for the week-long special session with the hope of passing laws banning mask and vaccine mandates. On Wednesday, DeSantis got his wish when Florida Republicans passed a package of four bills to combat COVID mandates. The governor signed them into law the following day.
Today, we lift people up.
That's right!
We provide protections for people. No nurse, no firefighter, no police officer, no trucker, no anybody should lose their job because of these COVID jabs.
Yes.
And that's what we're doing.
The three-day special session was described by Democrats as, quote, political theater. Of course, this isn't the first time Governor DeSantis has targeted COVID-related mandates. Since the start of the pandemic, he's aggressively fought public health measures, even suing the Biden administration over its vaccine requirement for federal contractors. For more on this, we're joined by Lawrence Maurer, reporter for the Tampa Bay Times and Miami Herald. Lawrence, great to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Why are we seeing a special legislative session in Florida? What's the big picture goal?
Well, the big picture goal here is to undo what this new rule by the Biden administration set by OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, that basically required companies with more than 100 employees to have their employees be vaccinated or submit to weekly testing. And for DeSantis, who has kind of had a contrarian approach to the pandemic, he said that, well, this doesn't take into account, this rule doesn't take into account all the different situations that people might be in. The vaccine is not a cure-all for everything, he says. And so to basically stop this rule and create legislation that is directly against that rule, he called for a special session.
Just remind us, how has DeSantis responded to the COVID-19 pandemic? What's been his approach?
Well, like I mentioned, contrarian is one way to put it. You know, at the beginning of the pandemic, DeSantis did shut down the state. You know, bars were closed for months. And, you know, there were even restrictions early on beach gatherings and stuff. But what DeSantis realized is that those measures didn't stop COVID. You know, whenever those things let up, COVID just came back. And in fact, you know, it, certainly in his perspective, those measures were, these lockdowns were pretty destructive, not just economically, but also on people's mental health. And so he's basically pushed back against the federal restrictions. He said that these federal lockdowns and restrictions don't take into account the full scope of people's COVID experience. They don't take into account the fact that if you do get COVID and do recover, you may have some natural immunity to it. And so he's kind of taken this natural immunity approach. He was very active on vaccines when they first came out. There was a big push on that he did on vaccines. He was doing daily press conferences. But as we've kind of learned, that vaccines are may not be the be all end all to this pandemic, and he DeSantis certainly has realized that and played into the fact that a lot of people just don't want to be vaccinated. DeSantis did not get his vaccine publicly. He's kind of accommodated those that sentiment and said basically, you know, not everyone's going to get vaccinated, and so what do we do about that? And firing people, as you heard, is not the answer.
Let's talk about the four bills being considered by the special session. And let's start with one about vaccine mandates. What does that entail? What conditions would be imposed on private employers?
Well, notably, this is not a ban on vaccine mandates. In fact, it makes vaccine mandates legal in Florida, fully legal. However, it says that employers who want to require employees to be vaccinated also have to provide five different opt-outs, different options for employees who do not want to be vaccinated. And those include, if you want to wear a mask in the workplace, that's one option. You can get a religious exemption, which is very vague, but you can also get a doctor's note saying if you're, stating that you're going to be pregnant or you are pregnant or expecting to be pregnant, that's an opt-out. It also offers for natural immunity, as they put it. If you have had COVID and you have a number of antibodies, you can go through weekly or some kind of medical test to show that you are immune from COVID. And you can, or you could also go through weekly testing. That's really what it does. It provides for these kind of opt-outs for people who don't want to get vaccinated.
And there's also the matter of mask mandates in schools. How did that play out in this special session?
Yes, what they did is basically said that school districts cannot decide whether or not your kid is masked or vaccinated. That's up to the parent. It basically gives a parent the right to say, I want my kid masked or not. And that's already an administrative rule in Florida, but that's now going to be the law.
Do we have a sense of what these bills mean for businesses and local governments? What kind of penalties they could incur?
Yeah, for local governments, I mean, it does ban vaccine mandates outright for local governments, schools. But for private employers, these are new restrictions that, frankly, they have not been thrilled about. Companies, businesses have said, look, we've been navigating the pandemic now for 18 months mm-hmm. or however, it's almost 2 years at this point. And we know how to run our businesses. We don't need more mandates. However, they're reluctant to go against the governor on this. Mm-hmm. You know, a number of companies have already rolled out vaccine mandates. They're now subject to, if they follow through on these, you know, the laws do provide a method for employees to complain to the attorney general. And there's fines included here of $10,000 per incident for companies of less than 100 employees and $50,000 for larger employers.
Governor DeSantis has been critical of OSHA's requirements for COVID safety. Tell me about the bill that would withdraw this day from OSHA. Is that even possible?
Well, yeah, it is possible to withdraw from OSHA. You know, about half the states have done that over the decades. It's not, you know, the bill, however, that was passed really doesn't withdraw the state from OSHA. It tells the governor's office to create a plan for a plan to leave OSHA. And this is something that would take years. OSHA would have to approve Florida's plan. It would cost Florida a lot of money. Right now, OSHA, you know, does most of the oversight of workplace safety in Florida. That would have to now fall to state government. And frankly, no one really thinks that this is actually going to happen. Republicans and Democrats were basically kind of privately acknowledging that this is just for show. Florida actually does leave OSHA, which would be at a minimum 3 to 5 years away, just to get federal approval to do it. When the bill comes for this, I imagine that most lawmakers are going to balk at the price tag.
That's interesting. What are some of the other bills the Florida legislature will consider during this session? Does one involve public records?
Yes. As I mentioned, there's a provision in the bill, in one of the bills, that allows for employees to complain about vaccine mandates to the attorney general, and the attorney general can levy fines based on those. Well, the employee complaints to the attorney general were also made secret through one of the other bills that was passed this week. And this was a pretty big argument. You know, instead of just, Florida has a pretty broad public records law. It's pretty good here. But in this case, the entire complaint would be secret. And of course, Democrats and others were saying, well, this is just going to be a way for, you know, selective enforcement. We don't know who the attorney general or who's complaining to the attorney general against which businesses. And we don't know if these complaints are secret. We don't know who the attorney general is enforcing, these complaints on. And so that did pass. And those are going to be secret until presumably 2023. You know, most of these provisions expire. That's one thing I didn't mention is that, you know, most of these provisions expire in 2023.
Lawrence, how much would you say DeSantis actually accomplished in this special session?
Well, we don't really know. There's a big wild card out here, which is that the OSHA rule is on hold right now because of a court basically put a stop to it, temporary hold on it. And if that rule does stand, then basically a lot of the work that was done this week will be for naught. It will overrule what Florida passed this week. However, if it fails, if the OSHA rule does not stand up, then yes, this will be in effect for every business in Florida and potentially have big ramifications.
Lawrence Maurer is a reporter for the Tampa Bay Times and the Miami Herald. Lawrence, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Bridget.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features.
Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
On this week's On the Media, one former NPR editor's grievances are reverberating far beyond a Substack essay. He claims wokeness is ruining the place.
That marginalized people are storming the barricades and dictating that this story happens and this story gets killed and we're going to use this language and not use that language. That's not what I saw.
On this week's On the Media from WNYC. Find On the Media wherever you get your podcasts.
This was the scene in New York City this past March when demonstrators took over the Brooklyn Bridge and called for undocumented workers to get direct financial assistance during the pandemic. At that point, they didn't qualify for any compensation. That includes Maria Sierra, a street vendor who says she's been working in New York City since 1993.
It's affected me a lot because I sell on the street independently. And, you know, everything was closed because everyone was infected. And I came here to sell, but nobody was outside.
So Sierra and others in her shoes decided it was time to take action. They marched, chanted, and even held a hunger strike. And eventually they won. New York would offer the country's largest excluded workers fund in April, a $2.1 billion relief program for undocumented workers, dwarfing California's $75 million deal. New Jersey and Washington followed with programs of their own. But now, a new problem is emerging. The money allocated to the workers is running out. In New York, nearly 350,000 people have filed claims for the fund, but over two-thirds of it has already been issued to over 130,000 people. That means that thousands of people who applied likely won't see any benefits. Advocates are calling for the funds to be renewed, but some have been met with opposition from lawmakers at the state level, leaving it unclear whether undocumented workers get another chance for pandemic relief. To find out more about these funds, I spoke with Bianca Guerrero, the campaign coordinator of the Fund Excluded Workers Coalition, and Amy Torres, executive director at the New Jersey Alliance for Immigrant Justice.
In New Jersey, the Recovery for All Coalition is a group that is pushing for New Jerseyans who have been excluded from federal relief. It's been more than a year and a half since the first federal relief checks from the pandemic went out, but many immigrant households were ineligible and excluded from that money. So there was a push at the state level to create a state fund that would provide relief for immigrants and workers who were excluded.
Bianca, in New York, they set up a $2 billion fund, and we've been hearing that that program is close to running dry. Can you talk about what's going on there?
For sure. So similar to New Jersey, our program is serving New Yorkers who are left out of unemployment and federal relief for the COVID pandemic. So far, nearly $2 billion has been doled out to New Yorkers across the state, and we are seeing record amounts of demand. At some points during the applications, which opened in August 1st, we saw up to 20,000 people applying each day. These are immigrant New Yorkers, undocumented New Yorkers who were on the front lines of the pandemic, whether they were delivery workers, domestic workers, day laborers, nannies, you name it, that really held down our state while the pandemic was raging, but we're left with nothing. And so finally, these folks are getting checks for up to $15,600 before taxes to pay down their debt, to buy their kids' school uniforms, to pay back utility bills and rent arrears. And for some people, to get out of abusive relationships and abusive workplaces, to pay off medical bills that they were unable to pay during the last year and a half. And we've heard from every corner of the state that while $2.1 billion is a really big number, it's simply not enough to meet the need. There are thousands of workers across the state, whether it's due to policy reasons or just because they didn't find out about the fund in time, or they struggle to gather documents because consulates were offering like appointments out months in advance to renew passports. For one reason or another, folks were unable to apply. So we've seen the money get spent down very, very quickly, which is exciting. We are really glad that money is getting into workers' hands. But at the same time, we're hearing that there's outstanding demand that needs to be met.
I know, Bianca, that your organization had to put a lot of work into just getting this initial fund set up. There was a lot of organizing that happened, rallies, you closed bridges, there was a hunger strike back in March. Can you talk more about what it took just to get this set up to begin with?
This all started in 2020 on the pantry lines across New York State. Organizers and community organizations that had shifted towards direct services, really realizing that the people who were most in need and didn't have any other recourse were undocumented New Yorkers. And, you know, having conversations with those workers to help them understand that they pay taxes, right? They pay taxes. Mm-hmm. They should be able to buy into or benefit from the social safety net that everyone else benefits from, and that is making unemployment insurance possible for the rest of New York during that really trying time. And so first it began with those conversations. It moved to legislative meetings to ask legislators at the state level to come up with a solution. And then it moved to marches, rallies, eventually culminating in a hunger strike in March into April of this year in both New York City and in Westchester. The organizing was really, really relentless throughout the hunger strike, which lasted 23 days. There was a foot washing ceremony where legislators were washing the feet of the hunger strikers. There was an Easter Day like procession and mass outside of Governor Cuomo's office to pressure him to include this in the budget. Everything was led by directly impacted workers who had enough and had nothing left to lose. And so they decided to put everything, including their well-being, on the line to secure this economic support for their communities.
Wow. And Amy, if you could talk about in New Jersey, I know it's a $40 million fund. It also took more than a year of pressure to secure it, also including hunger strikes. Why do you think it took so long? And is there some sort of lifeline for workers when the funds run out?
Look, I think if you were to ask decision makers what took so long, you'd likely hear answers ranging from we didn't know where the money would come from to, you know, there wasn't enough money to dole out this first time around. But I think from the perspective of community and what we've heard is that time and again, our communities feel ignored and deprioritized in state policies. And it's not lost on any of us that 2021 was a statewide election year for New Jersey. Mm-hmm. But in a state where one in four New Jerseyans is foreign born, where one in six of us lives with an immigrant household member, and where 17% of the state is part of the voting age, naturalized immigrant voting age citizens, every single issue is an immigrant justice issue, and recovery for all is a priority for our communities. To see the ways that our families have been left out, to see the ways that our neighbors have been left out, that our communities have been left out, is really disheartening. But we feel hopeful for the road ahead. I think there's a two-pronged approach to how we make sure that this fund actually delivers on what our communities deserve. The fund at $40 million is a flat cap per household, $2,000 per household, for individuals that were excluded from federal stimulus and pandemic aid. And at that amount, the fund is expected to reach fewer than 10% of individuals who were excluded. Wow.
Bianca, this is the first time New York has set up a fund like this, but there was a finite amount of funding, as you said. But Amy raised a point that is very relevant in New York, which is this is a very big election year coming in New York. What effort is being put into instituting an ongoing fund like this? And to what extent do you think it will become an issue in this upcoming cycle of elections?
Yeah, I definitely agree with Amy around everything that was mentioned about the need for more money and a proper rollout. This will definitely be a prominent issue in the 2020 cycle, both for the legislature and making sure that we secure much more money for in next year's budget, and I'm sure in the gubernatorial considerations as well. And it'll be a big issue because we have thousands of workers across the state who have learned about the fund, who have been left out and don't think it's fair that just because they didn't find out about something in a 9 month or 9 week window when the applications were open, that means that they should be saddled with the debt from the pandemic or any of the economic sacrifices that they've made for the rest of their life. Right. They are New Yorkers just like everyone else, and they deserve to be supported by their state government just as well. We are really glad that Governor Hochul has made distributing the existing funds as a priority from day one. But we also know that the true test of success for this program and the true test of success for her dedication to immigrant New Yorkers will be on making sure the full job is complete, that every single excluded worker in New York that is eligible receives the benefits that they need.
I wanted to ask, getting the funds set up, obviously, it was the first step. But I wonder if, Amy, you would speak to the access challenges associated with it when, you know, you're trying to reach people, maybe some of whom are in urban areas, but maybe some who are in rural areas, you know, that aren't as connected to some of the community organizations who could help them with the applications and some of the associated paperwork. You know, what needs to be done to ensure that people who are actually eligible know these funds exist and can do what they need to do to apply for them?
Well, I think the top priority is making sure that there's more money in the fund. If you're someone who's applying and you've been excluded from the process for this long, to see a small amount and know that there are sometimes onerous documentation requirements like the ones that Bianca mentioned, that there might be a lot of paperwork that needs to be gathered that you don't have access to at the moment. It's not difficult to imagine that someone would then be disincentivized from applying simply because they think they won't be the first to take a shot at a very small, small slice of a small pie. But there's only so much that can happen with a limited pool. With a larger pool, we can deeply invest in public education and outreach, make sure that people are able to find the documents that they need to prove eligibility, and that we can also take the learnings from this initial process to refine the application process going forward and make sure that people are not having to prove negativity and instead prove their eligibility for the fund.
Amy Torres is Executive Director of the New Jersey Alliance for Immigrant Justice, and Bianca Guerrero is the Campaign Coordinator of the Fund Excluded Workers Coalition. Thanks so much to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This weekend marks Transgender Day of Remembrance, an annual vigil which honors the memory of those murdered in acts of anti-transgender violence. It's held every year on November 20th. The day was started in part to pay tribute to a Black trans woman named Rita Hester, who was stabbed to death in her apartment in Boston in 1998. Hester was subsequently misgendered by police and media covering her death. Trans activist Gwendolyn Ann Smith created a website in 1999 to remember Hester and other victims of anti-trans violence. According to the Human Rights Campaign, with still over a month left in the year, 2021 has been the deadliest year for transgender or gender nonconforming people on record, and most of those people killed were Black or Latinx. But it's also worth noting that trans murders often go inaccurately reported because of misgendering by police and media, so the numbers in any given year could be much higher. Advocates say that this violence against trans people is fueled by anti-trans political rhetoric. 2021 also marks the most anti-trans bills that have been introduced in state legislatures than any previous year on record. Orion Rumler is a reporter on the breaking news team at the 19th. He joined us to talk about the significance of the Transgender Day of Remembrance and recent legislation that impacts trans people.
This day every year honors the trans people, predominantly Black and Latino women, who were killed this year. The way this day is usually celebrated is by holding a candlelight vigil, and someone volunteers to read the names of everyone who died this year. So saying their names is a way to honor them, to see them, because in a lot of cases, these are women, gender nonconforming people, and trans men who were not recognized by their families, by their communities. In some cases, they may be misgendered by the police even after their deaths. So TDOR, or Trans Day of Remembrance, is a way to affirm those who have been lost, to say we see you and to remember them.
This was a record-breaking year for anti-trans legislation around the country. Can you tell us about some of the laws that were enacted?
Sure. So like you said, there were a record number of bills introduced this year. Most of those targeted trans youth sports participation in schools, K through 12 grades, and access to gender-affirming care like puberty blockers and hormone therapy for minors. Texas was the state that introduced the most bills like over triple the number of bills of any other state. And they introduced 50 if you count sports, gender-affirming care, and also bills that would have blocked birth certificate updates for minors. And the majority of legislation that's passed across the country, only a handful of bills have passed. They're almost always about sports, except for Arkansas, which passed a ban for gender-affirming care, although that's in legal limbo. And Tennessee also passed a gender-affirming care ban, but Tennessee's bill in that area isn't considered that it would actually do anything, because in Tennessee's law, the text doesn't understand that prepubescent trans kids would not be accessing this care.
Orion, it's very interesting as you lay out the types of laws that were passed. I hear you talking about issues of sports and birth certificates, but it sounds like the word transgender is not used in a lot of the legislation. What do you think the significance of that is?
No, absolutely. So me and my colleague, Kate Sozin, we looked through 102 of these bills, most of them in Texas, and the word transgender only comes up a handful of times. Advocates tell us, and trans people living in Texas who are also advocates tell us, that that makes them feel like their existence is not being acknowledged. And I think it also goes deeper, because like this legislation is aimed at restricting what kind of activities trans kids can do in terms of sports and the care they can receive, but the language doesn't acknowledge that it's about trans people. And you also see that in the debates, especially in the Texas legislature. They had three special sessions this year, and the trans kids playing in sports was a priority for the governor in every session. The debate was like from two different planets. I mean, on one side, they're trying to get the other side to acknowledge that this is about trans people. And even that acknowledgement, it wouldn't come easily. It was like, it just kept being dragged out into where the proponents of the bills would say, this is not about trans kids. This is about protecting girls in sports. And so like when you drill down into it, their language is saying trans girls are not girls, and that's why this is not about trans people. So it's a weird, convoluted language. And the bottom line is that advocates tell us that it's done intentionally. And it's a technique that we also saw in the language in bathroom bills several years ago.
Orion, did your reporting find what the link was between this anti-trans rhetoric and legislation and the violence against transgender people?
Yes. So we did talk with experts early this year, because we did expect this year to be the deadliest on record for trans people since this spring. So this was a long time coming. We knew it was going to be the deadliest. And the advocates were worried that the language in these bills that depicts trans women as, quote, biological men would be rhetoric that would fuel hatred, basically, would fuel misunderstanding, would confuse people about what being transgender is. I would add that I've spoken with researchers who look into this area, and that link hasn't been proven. We need more research and we need more data, but that is what advocates are afraid of.
On the local level, can you tell us about other anti-LGBTQ initiatives making their way through school districts and around the country?
Yes. So we're seeing school districts ban pride flags this year, including trans and non-binary flags, saying that it's political speech. I talked with a Florida teacher in St. John's County and told me about one of her students who started wearing a trans flag as a cape in protest of their school cracking down. And when I talked to the deputy superintendent, I believe, of that county, the way he explained the new policy to me was like, we've already had this policy in place, but now we are reminding people that this is how it should be done. So their explanation to me was like, this is not a new policy, but we're telling schools that you need to take pride flags out of schools that had been letting them circulate. So we're seeing that. And my colleague Nadra Niddle reported earlier this week about children's books by LGBTQ authors being banned in some schools. Some of those books are specifically meant for trans, genderqueer, and non-binary youth.
Wow. Has there been any positive legislation or protections for trans people or other positive milestones for trans people this year?
Yes. Yeah, so it's basically two different stories at the federal level and the state or local level right now. At the federal level, we're seeing protections put in place as the Biden administration has made a point to reverse policies that were put in place during the Trump administration. The HHS restored anti-discrimination protections, and the Biden overturned the transgender military ban that was highly publicized when Trump implemented it. And HUD withdrew a Trump-era proposal that would have let federally funded emergency shelters exclude trans people. And the Pentagon said it would provide gender-affirming care. And the Justice Department said in September that it would review policies on trans inmates in federal prison. And this is all happening as the Biden White House has made an effort to meet with advocates. I don't know if we're seeing the fruit of those meetings yet, but the White House has met twice with intersex advocates this year virtually to talk about how to advance domestic protections against things like invasive unnecessary surgeries. And the White House met with trans women of color this summer for similar reasons.
So some steps forward. Orion Rumler, reporter on the breaking news team at the 19th, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Bridget. I appreciate it.
All right, everyone, that's our show. But one important last note on a story we've been following closely on The Takeaway. On Thursday, Governor Kevin Stitt granted clemency to Julius Jones just hours before his execution. Jones was convicted and sentenced to death for the 1999 killing of Paul Howell. He has consistently claimed his innocence and spoken out about the ineffectiveness of the counsel he received. The Oklahoma Parole and Pardons Board voted to recommend both commutation and clemency for Jones, with the final decision going to the governor. While Governor Stitt spared Jones's life, it comes with the caveat that Jones will spend the rest of his life in jail. He won't be eligible to apply or be considered for pardon, parole, or commutation, at least for now. Jones's grateful family vows to continue the fight for his freedom. Here's his sister Antoinette talking to local media.
We don't stop here. We still have to get him out. So we don't stop here. Yeah.
We'll have more on this story on Monday. Thanks so much for being with us. I'm Bridget Bergen, in for Melissa Harris-Perry. We'll be back on Monday. And this is The Takeaway.